Hello, welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, April 5th, 2026. Happy Easter, everyone. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sunsounds of Arizona. And on this Easter Sunday, as we do on any other Sunday with the second hour, we start by reading the obituaries. Today's list includes the following names: Peggy Lynn Allaire, Alfred R. Autry, Douglas Dean Batchelder, Dabney Lee Buckley, Brian Dowling, Bradley Don Gardner, Melvin Lee Garrett, Richard Glasgow, Margaret P. Hogan, Leonard Caston, Lana Jane Lucero, Carolyn Ruth Gromer Plath, Margaret Ellen Poundstone, Dr. Raul M. Rodillas, Judy Ann Van Dyke, and Margaret Eileen Waldron. Sunsounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of the individuals listed in today's obituaries. And now we'll turn to the economy section of the paper. There are two articles from that section of the paper. They're fairly long articles. The first one is California Billionaires Threatening Exodus by Daniel DeVice for the USA Today. A proposal to tax California's billionaires is testing the limits of America's enthusiasm for making the ultra-wealthy individuals pay their share. The so-called billionaire tax would raise an estimated $100 billion through a one-time 5% wealth tax on roughly 200 California billionaires. Proponents are collecting signatures to get the tax on the November ballot. Now, the billionaire tax is polling well among California voters. Half of them support it, 28% oppose it. That's according to a survey that was released in March by UC Berkeley and Politico. But California Governor Gavin Newsom opposes the tax, and some of the state's most prominent billionaires say they would rather move than pay it. Those who could decamp to more tax-friendly states include Google co-founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin, PayPal co-founder Peter Thiel, and venture capitalist David Sachs. That's according to a report from the National Taxpayers Union Foundation. Meta founder Mark Zuckerberg reportedly is eyeing a move to Florida. In a January post on X, billionaire Chamath Palihapitiya claimed that Californians worth a collective $700 billion had already left the state. Critics of the billionaire tax say the exodus portends failure for the measure before it has reached the ballot. Andrew Wilford, who is director of state policy at the National Taxpayers Union Foundation, that's a taxpayer advocacy group, Andrew said, quote, "If the goal is to raise as much revenue from billionaires as possible, having them leave is not the best way to do it," unquote. California's billionaire tax may be an outlier, but the wealth tax has taken off in recent years as a way to raise revenue from top earners in politically progressive states. In 2022, Massachusetts voters approved the Fair Share Amendment. It enacts a 4% surtax on annual incomes greater than $1 million in order to fund education and transportation. That tax generated $2.5 billion in its first year. Washington state lawmakers recently approved a 9.9% tax on annual incomes greater than $1 million. And that's in a state that levies no other income tax. And that millionaire's tax is projected to raise $3.4 billion a year. New York City's new mayor, Zoran Mamdani, wants to raise income taxes on city residents earning more than $1 million a year, boosting its top tax rate from roughly 3.9%, raise it up to 5.9%. The notion of taxing the ultra-wealthy has populist appeal in an era of rising income inequality. The top 10% of the wealthy Americans now control 60% of the nation's wealth. That's according to a 2024 report from the Congressional Budget Office. The 12 wealthiest billionaires alone hold more wealth than the poorer half of the world's population, according to a 2026 report from the global non-governmental organization called Oxfam. Gallup polling shows only 12% of Americans think upper-income people pay too much tax, while 58% believe they pay too little. The standard objection to taxing the rich holds that raising the levies will chase them away. Responding to a cavalcade of headlines about California billionaires leaving the state, Newsom told Political, quote, "This is my fear. It's just what I warned against. It's happening," unquote. The billionaire tax might still raise billions of dollars in net revenues, however, because it's a one-time tax. If billionaires leave California for good, their future earnings could leave with them. Jared Walczak, senior fellow at the Nonpartisan Tax Foundation, Jared said, quote, "If you have people who leave and never come back over a one-time tax, you have decades of income tax that you will never get back," unquote. Well, supporters of the California tax say those fears are overblown. Carl Davis, who is a research director at the left-leaning Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, Carl said, quote, "For the people who are going to pay this, the California wealth tax will have zero impact on their standard of living or their kids' standard of living or their grandkids' standard of living. It's a drop in the bucket," unquote. Based on past experience, Davis predicts the number of billionaires who might leave California over the billionaire tax, quote, "will be greater than zero, but still very, very small," unquote. Massachusetts has seen an increase in millionaires rather than a decrease since that state enacted higher taxes on higher earners. That's according to a report from the Progressive Institute for Policy Studies. But every state has seen an increase in millionaires, according to the Tax Foundation in a rebuttal. Massachusetts has gained them at a slower rate than most other states. Most prior wealth taxes have targeted income. The California initiative focuses instead on wealth. Income taxes often fail to tap the wealth of the wealthiest Americans, studies show, because much of their wealth does not come from taxable income. Very wealthy Americans avoid taxes by amassing wealth in stocks and real estate. Those assets tend to grow in value, but the owner does not pay capital gains taxes until they sell. And when they die, the assets often pass tax-free to their heirs. Davis said, quote, "A large amount of income is never subject to tax at all. It is income that never appears on tax forms. It just vanishes into thin air," unquote. The collective wealth of California billionaires rose from $300 billion in 2011 to $2.2 trillion in 2025, according to a fact sheet from proponents of the billionaire tax. They term this tax an emergency to offset catastrophic federal cuts in funding for health care, food assistance, and education during the Trump administration. Janelle Jones, who is a senior fellow at the Progressive Groundwork Collaborative, Janelle said, quote, "My favorite solution would be, let's have some federal investment into health care that would make it more affordable. But I don't think that's going to happen," unquote. Well, even as they mull the moves California billionaires are raising millions of dollars to fight the billionaire tax if it winds up on the November ballot. If voters approve it, observers say the billionaire tax will deliver the ultimate test of how far cities and states can go in taxing their wealthiest residents, and whether those taxpayers will stick around. And that was the article, California Billionaires Threatening Exodus. Our second article from the economy section of the paper, shopping malls are hitting resurgence thanks to Gen Z. This was written by Betty Lynn Fisher for the USA Today. The 1980s are calling, and it's not to Generation X. Shopping malls, once the mainstay of teens during the 1980s and 90s, are enjoying a resurgence. And it's thanks to Gen Z shoppers who are craving in-person and social outlets over online shopping conveniences. Annabelle Sacco, who is 24, of Bloomfield, Michigan, does a combination of shopping online and at the mall, where she has seen an increase of shoppers her age. Sacco told the USA Today, quote, "The mall is an experience. You go there, you see all different kinds of people, and it's just getting out of your isolation in your home," unquote. Going to the mall also satisfies the need to get something right away and reduces time spent on returning online purchases. Her size often varies depending on the brand, so going to the mall and trying on clothes makes it easier to find the right fit. Shoppers like Sacco are a key reason why mall traffic is on the rise. According to Placer.ai, which uses a panel of tens of millions of devices and machine learning to make estimations for in-store visits across the country. According to Placer.ai, traffic to indoor malls was up 4.5% in January and February from the previous year. Elizabeth LaFontaine, who is director of research at Placer.ai, said, quote, "The resurgence of the mall category directly correlates with Gen Z shoppers' desires for community and in-person connection," unquote. Male-based retailers and brands are harnessing the power of social media to connect directly with Gen Z audiences, both physically in stores and digitally, as young shoppers use social media to share tips and for trend research. Shoppers aged 18 to 24 bought 62% of their total general merchandise purchases in stores last year, according to Circana. Shoppers ages 25 and older made 52% of their purchases in person. Now, Gen Z is expected to spend $12 trillion by the year 2030, according to Nielsen IQ and World Data Lab. Gen Z's share of foot traffic at malls increased 57% year over year, according to the company PwC Data. But, according to Ali Furman, who is the PwC U.S. Consumer Markets industry leader, said, young shoppers are selective. They are returning to value-oriented shopping malls, which have stores and brands also often located in suburban strip malls rather than high-end luxury brands. There's also variance across the country. Along the West Coast, Gen Zers are frequenting malls more, with California being the top state at a 62% gain in foot traffic. But Furman said, quote, "The simple experience of shopping in person feels novel. It is a sensory and social experience they cannot replicate through their screens," unquote. Furman said her team also believes that Generation Alpha, those who are 13 years old and younger, are not far behind the Gen Z shoppers in spurring a return to the mall. In a survey of 3,000 shoppers in the United States and Canada by Lightspeed Commerce, 75% of those between the ages of 18 and 24 say third spaces inside stores which includes cafes and lounges or social areas, influence where they choose to shop. USA Today was given an exclusive first look at those survey results. Now, Gen Z, as a generation, feels very isolated, so it's not a surprise that they are leading the charge back to in-person stores and malls, according to Dax DeSilva, who is CEO of Lightspeed Commerce. Dax said, quote, "This stems from this generation growing up a lot during the pandemic and having a very different reality than most of us," unquote. He went on to say, many members of Gen Z want to meet up with friends at a store or mall to combat the loneliness. 67% of respondents said stores with social or community features make them feel less isolated. And Dax said, it's a good opportunity for retailers to go beyond the merchandise to create social moments to entice the younger generation to go to the store and find a reason to stay in the store and have it be a part of their social dynamic, unquote. And that was the article, Shopping Malls Are Hitting Resurgence Thanks to Gen Z. We're coming up on 17 minutes past the hour, so we're going to move on over to the sports section now. Well, on the sports section, everything is about the women's Final Four. And I thought we would share the article written by one of our local sports writers, Bob McManaman. He's a columnist for the Arizona Republic. And his article is entitled, Clash of Coaches Adds Spice to Semifinals. They laughed, they cried, they screamed, and they sighed. And now only two remain. The NCAA Women's Final Four showcased every type of emotion imaginable, as well as some outstanding basketball on Friday, April 3rd at Mortgage Matchup Center. It was exactly what one would expect from a tournament featuring four number one seeds, and the same four schools from a year ago. Only this time, it happened here in downtown Phoenix, and Arizona's first venture hosting the Women's Final Four is sure to create many more unforgettable memories, considering what awaits in the championship game on Sunday, April 5th. Three-time national champion South Carolina, making its sixth consecutive Final Four appearance, will face UCLA for the 2026 title. Tip-off is at 12:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. The Gamecocks, whose record is 36 wins and 3 losses, advanced by defeating the defending champion and the previously unbeaten UConn by a score of 62-48 in the first NCAA semifinal. The Bruins, whose record was 35-1, seeking their first women's national title in school history, got to the Final Four by downing Texas 51-44 in the second semifinal to avenge their only loss of the season. But what happens in the finale of the Big Dance might be hard to top in terms of some of the energy and the theatrics that occurred before, during, and after the South Carolina-UConn game. The drama started when Huskies coach Gino Auriemma was upset that Gamecocks coach Don Staley did not meet him near mid-court for the traditional pre-game coach's handshake. He said he waited for her for, quote, nearly 3 minutes, unquote. And then things got a little more heated in the first half after UConn sophomore forward Sarah Strong, who is the consensus NCAA Player of the Year, had her jersey ripped and needed to make a wardrobe change. Auriemma contended she was fouled, but no call was made, and it appeared on replays that the jersey tear was accidentally self-inflicted. Later, Auriemma complained that he didn't like the way Staley seemed to be having a volatile conversation with game officials, suggesting the opposing coach probably should have been hit with a technical foul. And when the game was just about to end, Ariyama and Staley had a heated exchange that everyone witnessed and most found uncomfortable to watch. They appeared to briefly shake hands, but Ariyama said something that Staley didn't like. She barked back, and Ariyama, who was still peeved, and the confrontation didn't stop until a UConn assistant and an official intervened. Staley said was still seething as Ariyama walked away. The video caught her saying, quote, "I will beat Gino's ass," unquote. Well, so what started the fracas? Afterwards, Staley said, "You can ask Gino the question. He's the one that initiated the conversation. I don't want what happened there to dampen what we were able to accomplish today," unquote. Well, when asked to explain his side of the story, Ariyama said, quote, "I just said what I had to say. Nothing. Nothing." Later on, he said, "I said what I said, and obviously she didn't like it. I just told the truth," unquote. Well, the uneasiness of the whole dust-up was real, but it doesn't diminish a thing as to what Staley and South Carolina have accomplished. 6 straight Final Fours and 3 national titles since 2017 is no easy task. If anything, Staley is more disappointed and dejected about what happened in 2023 when her team failed to reach the championship game. Staley said, quote, "For me, I'm haunted by 2023. I'm haunted by that particular Final Four because of the players that we had and the season that we were having. It got upended. Yeah, we won it the following year, but that particular group was pretty special. I'm still haunted by it. For me, if we ever get the opportunity to be in that position again, which we were today, we're going to lay it on the line, okay? We're going to lay it on the line, figure out ways in which to win the game. And I thought our kids locked into that," unquote. UConn, meanwhile, looked uncharacteristically unsettled. Whether it was South Carolina's tenacious defense or smallish guard Raven Johnson's surprise assignment guarding strong, or the Huskies' inability to make a single field goal in the final 4 minutes and 39 seconds, it was an unusual night for a Huskies program making its 25th Final Four appearance and seeking its 13th national title. Scoring 48 points? UConn usually beats teams by 48 points. And deep down, that's probably what sent Ariyama into a tizzy, if that's what people call it. He certainly drew his share of criticism on social media after what transpired on an otherwise glorious afternoon and evening of college basketball. Ariyama said, quote, "I think we know how to win with class, and we know how to win with dignity. We win with humility. But the true test is how you handle yourself in this moment, the way they were in the locker room, how they handled that moment. I want always for our team to be able to handle both moments the exact same way," unquote. Ariyama's players handled the loss with grace. Their coach did not. But don't expect him to walk away now at the age of 72. He's under contract through 2029. And having previously said that he will return next season, Ariyama might have joked after the loss that he doesn't feel like coaching again. But he isn't going anywhere, except probably back to yet another Final Four. He said, quote, "We'll be back here next year." And then, thinking of Strong, he said, "And she will make sure of that," unquote. And that was Bob McManaman's column or article, "Clash of Coaches Adds Spice to Semifinals." Our next article from the interior of the sports section is all about baseball. D-backs set to face Mets and Phillies April 7 through 12, written by Jose M. Romero for the Arizona Republic. The Arizona Diamondbacks finish up a weekend series with the Atlanta Braves on Sunday, April 5th, with right-hander Brandon Pfaadt on the mound looking for his first win of the season. Brandon faced the Detroit Tigers on Tuesday, March 31st, in a no decision after six innings pitched in his first start of the 26th season. He won a career-high 13 games last season. The Diamondbacks get a day off on Monday, April 6th, before the start of the team's second road trip of the season. It's a lengthy one. It starts with three games against the New York Mets in Flushing, New York, followed by three games in Philadelphia and three in Baltimore. The Mets won their opening series against the Pittsburgh Pirates, lost their next series to the St. Louis Cardinals, and they ended the week in San Francisco. The Diamondbacks took two of three games from the Mets at Citi Field last season, and they lost two of three at Chase Field. New York lost slugger Pete Alonso in free agency to the Orioles, but they have veteran stars like Francisco Lindor and Juan Soto. After leaving New York, the Diamondbacks will meet the Phillies, with whom they split the six-game season series back in 2025. Philadelphia lost its season opening series at home to the Texas Rangers, and then they took two of three from the Washington Nationals before finishing their week in Colorado against the Rockies. Stars Kyle Schwarber and Bryce Harper were off to slow starts on offense to begin the season. Now, all three games against the Mets are at 4:10 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, with the Phillies' start times at 3:40 p.m. on then Friday, April 10th at 10:05 a.m., on Saturday, April 11th at 10:35 a.m., on Sunday, April 12th. And those were the that was the article, D-backs set to face Mets and Phillies April 7th through the 12th. Next little article is about college softball, written by Jenna Ortiz for the Arizona Republic. ASU to return home to face UTEP and UCF. Arizona State softball will return to Tempe after spending the last two weekends on the road. The Sun Devils fared well in non-conference play, but they've hit some tough stretches in Big 12 play, including a sweep from Utah in the conference opener. However, ASU did go 3-3 against ranked opponents Oklahoma State and University of Arizona, getting the season back on track. The Sun Devils will start their home slate with a midweek game against UTEP on Tuesday, April 7th at 1 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. Now, ASU had beaten UTEP 10-1 in a previous meeting back on March 10th. And then, ASU will face a tough series against UCF from April 10th through the 12th. The Knights have had a good season, and they are close to being one of the top 25 teams in the country. So, let's see, what kind of activities do we have? April 5th, that's Sunday, all times Mountain Standard Time, women's tennis versus Colorado at the Whitman Tennis Center at noon, men's tennis at the Michael and Ann Greenwood Tennis Center at noon. On April 7th, it's softball versus UTEP at Farrington Stadium at 1 p.m., baseball at Grand Canyon Brazil Field at GCU Ballpark at 6:05 p.m. On April 8th, baseball versus UNLV at Phoenix Municipal Stadium, 6:35 p.m. April 9th, it'll be women's tennis at BYU at the BYU Tennis Courts Building at noon. And men's tennis will be at BYU at the BYU Indoor Tennis Courts at 4 p.m. And then on April 10th, men's golf at Thunderbird Collegiate Papago Golf Club all day long. Beach volleyball versus California at the Swanson Beach Volleyball Complex at 11:15 a.m. Water polo at MPSF Championships Spiker Aquatics Complex, but the time is still to be announced. And beach volleyball will be at Cal Poly at the Swanson Beach Volleyball Complex at 1:45 p.m. And finally, softball versus UCF at Farrington Stadium on April 10th at 6 p.m. And that is all about ASU spring sports. ASU to return home to face UTEP and UCF. Well, we're at 30 minutes past the hour, so we move on over to the viewpoint section to read a couple of opinion pieces. And at the top of the page, there's this an electrical outlet, and there's some kind of electrical cord coming close to one of the outlets. And underneath the picture, it says power surge. And then underneath that picture, there are two articles. So I guess there's two opinion pieces all about electrical power. The first one is entitled Formula-Based Utility Rates Don't Add Up for Consumers. This is a opinion piece written by Diane E. Brown, a guest columnist. If you find it challenging to pay your utility bill or are concerned about the cost of running your air conditioner for the next 6 months in order to stay comfortable, you are not alone. Unfortunately, the end is not in sight. Based on recent actions and statements by the elected members of the Arizona Corporation Commission, Arizona ratepayers are likely to see bills continue to increase each year for 5 years after a rate case is decided. And the reason? Well, soon after the Commission approved a new rate-making option for utilities known as formula rates, the floodgates opened. Arizona Public Service, EPCOR, Liberty Utilities, Southwest Gas, Tucson Electric Power, and UNS Gas not only proposed to raise ratepayer rates, but also to use this new mechanism known as formula rates. Well, as you can imagine, utilities typically don't push for, applaud adoption, or propose a change if it doesn't provide an advantage for them or their shareholders. Now don't forget, Salt River Project doesn't have shareholders and is not regulated by the commission. While there are instances when consumers simultaneously benefit from a utility recommendation, experiences across this country indicate this is not one of them. With formula rates, the more a utility spends on infrastructure, the greater its opportunity to profit, and the lower the ability to check against wasteful spending. So as a result, ratepayers in states with formula rates have experienced higher rates alongside decreased transparency and decreased opportunities for public engagement. Now in Arizona, the process for formula rates enables utilities to adjust rates annually for up to 5 years, based on a predetermined, pre-approved formula that guarantees a return for shareholders. Utilities argue that formula rates facilitate investment in generation and transmission and reduce regulatory lag. However, they failed to point out that commissioners approved the System Reliability Benefit and Systems Improvement Benefit mechanisms to enable them to recover cost for items like infrastructure closer to when the expense was incurred, or that regulatory lag is good for ratepayers because it means a utility operates with a preset budget and there's a check on their incentive to overinvest. Although formula rates are in place, our commission has yet to require meaningful guardrails on formula rates, including protection against overinvestment that shifts financial risk from utilities and their shareholders to ratepayers, to outline the information a utility is expected to provide, or criteria for measuring outcomes, or to set expectations for programs to benefit customers. Additionally, it is alarming how quickly a rate increase can now be approved. A conventional rate case for the larger utilities usually takes 12 to 18 months. During that time, commission staff and interveners challenge utility assumptions and present evidence from expert witnesses. Consumers have opportunities to provide input. A judge presides over the process, with commissioners making the ultimate decision on how much customers will pay and how much shareholders can earn. But under formula rates, the process is significantly reduced to 120 days. That's a timeline that favors utilities that employ a plethora of individuals versus nonprofit organizations working on behalf of consumers with a small staff, like ours, that don't. Even commission staff and the state's Residential Utility Consumer Office, the two entities that analyze every major electric, gas, water, and wastewater rate case, they've never been asked to achieve such a comprehensive review in that short of a time period, and they'll be hard-pressed to conduct a thorough assessment in this 120-day time frame. And to make matters worse, once a formula rate is approved, the utility is allowed to come back every year for 5 years to true up expenses. In other words, if a utility's sales are less than expected, or their expenses are higher than expected, they get to charge you more, essentially eliminating any incentive to control cost. And all utility true-ups could occur at the same time, diminishing the capacity for comprehensive scrutiny. If you are a consumer who has an electric, gas, and water utility regulated by the commission, this means you could be faced with a triple blow to your budget annually for 5 years, as less scrutiny means each utility is likely to receive and pass along a rate increase and an increase in the amount you pay each month for service. Utilities in Arizona that deliver reliable service have a right to recover prudent cost. Utility shareholders are entitled to receive a reasonable return on their investment. However, commissioners are elected to strike a balance, and right now the balance is heavily weighted toward the utilities and their shareholders over ratepayers. Commissioners need to follow the lead of Commissioner Lee Marquez Peterson and stand up for ratepayers. Alongside Arizona PIRG Education Fund and RUCO and consumer advocates in our state that oppose the implementation of formula rates and want to ensure consumers see relief from high utility bills. And that was an opinion piece by Diane E. Brown. She is the executive director of the Arizona Public Interest Research Group Education Fund, a statewide organization that conducts research and education on issues in the public interest. She serves as a consumer advocate on APS, SRP, TEP, and UNS stakeholder groups. And her opinion piece was entitled, Formula-Based Utility Rates Don't Add Up for Consumers. Now the next article, or opinion piece, is written by Rachel Walden, and it's entitled, Utility Formula Rates Keep Costs Down. Here's how. Affordability has quickly become the word for 2026. Across the political spectrum, people are working to define what affordability looks like. For my efforts at the Arizona Corporation Commission, affordability means leveraging every tool available to keep costs down and minimize rate increases for customers. The Commission recently approved its first formula rate, known as the Annual Rate Adjustment Mechanism for UNS Gas, a Class A electric utility. This method of setting rates has multiple benefits to help reduce cost versus the traditional method that the Commission has been using. It eliminates costly regulatory lag, which in turn provides utilities access to lower interest rate loans and capital to invest in building and maintaining critical infrastructure. Savings can be captured annually. Expenditures have more scrutiny, and rate increases are exacerbated by time are removed as utilities no longer wait years before coming in for a rate case review. UNS Gas went 14 years between rate cases. A 10.3% rate increase was approved. Using traditional rate making with a historic test year, customers see the increase all at once as the utility's cost of doing business has outpaced the approved rates they are allowed to collect. Using formula rate making, the increases, if any, will instead be gradual, enabling households to budget annually if there is any change in the rates. For the traditional method of rate setting, expenditures, and capital investments are only evaluated for the chosen year for evaluation, which is known as the test year, and not for all of the years in between the rate cases. This could give utilities the opportunity to game the system. They may hold off on repairs and projects until the test year to then demonstrate a bloated revenue requirement that is not representative of normal operating procedure. Under traditional historic test year rate making, the Commission and stakeholders have no means to assess whether utilities' business operations are in line with prior years or whether there was unusual activity that cannot be easily explained. Under the ARAM, all expenses and capital outlay will now be reviewed every year. The test for prudency and used and usefulness will still be performed. The Commission maintains the authority to remove or revise the expenditures that are included in the rates and will still vote in an open meeting before any changes are finalized. The difference now is that we will have increased oversight to review costs from year to year in real time. We can ensure that spending is not excessive in relation to the cost of providing safe and reliable service. The ARAM will allow savings to be passed directly on to customers, such as the corporate tax cuts from the One Big Beautiful Bill. In the traditional rate-setting method, if the utility's test year that is used in their rate case is outside of the year when federal or state tax cuts are applicable, the savings do not get passed down to the ratepayer. Using the ARAM, tax savings will be passed down to ratepayers each year they occur. The ARAM also gives the opportunity for a rate decrease, which does not exist in the method the Commission has traditionally used. Though the vote to pass the ARAM for UNS Gas represented a historic moment for Arizona, this method of rate making is not at all new. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has used formula rates to set transmission rates for all 50 states for the past 60 years. And states like Mississippi, Louisiana, and Arkansas, just to name a few, utilize formula rate making, some since the early 1990s. The U.S. Energy Information Administration data shows that every one of these states have affordable electricity rates well below the national average and enjoy some of the lowest electricity rates in the nation. Formula rates can and are used for setting rates for any type of utility service. If you support increased transparency and strong regulatory oversight and affordability, join me in support of formula rate making. Rachel Walden is the Vice Chair of the Arizona Corporation Commission and is a governing board member for Mesa Public Schools. She previously had a career in finance, and her opinion piece is entitled, Utility Formula Keeps Rates Keeps Cost Down. Here's How. Both of those articles were under the big picture at the top of the viewpoint section entitled Power Surge. Well, we have a couple of minutes left. How about reading a couple of opinions from people like you and me in the letters to the editor? Well, here's the first letter in the section of the paper known as Letters to the Editor. While President Trump and his war machine are spending gigantic amounts of taxpayer dollars in the Middle East and are asking for $200 billion more, we have major issues here in our country that need attention now. TSA employees had gone without pay until March 30th. And are leaving their jobs because the president is holding Congress hostage over his erroneously named Save America Act, which is in reality a voter restriction bill. In the wake of DOGE efforts, people like me cannot reach the Social Security Administration when we need to. We have a U.S. Postal Service in financial crisis, and Congress is doing nothing about it. If they think we don't realize that they are trying to unfairly influence the upcoming 2026 elections by jeopardizing our ability to receive our ballots and vote via mail, they are all mistaken. I paid $4.99 a gallon for gas and had an outrageous bill at the grocery store. As a citizen who willingly pays my taxes to support good health care, good public education, affordable housing, veterans care, etc., I am demanding that the President and Congress get back to work and stop gold-plating everything in the White House. Signed, Susan Olson in Phoenix. Our next letter goes, in a long and proud tradition, Arizona has mail-in voting in a well-run operation. States have the authority to hold and operate their own elections. We must be able to continue our tradition and not allow Donald Trump and the Supreme Court to hamper our state's system. The court seemed poised to restrict mail-in voting. Ironically, Donald Trump used it recently. Save Arizona's mail-in voting, even if we have to pass additional legislation to keep it. Signed, Bobby Bookhout in Tempe. We've passed 45 minutes past the hour, so we need to move on over to the entertainment section, and we begin by reading today's horoscopes. Well, if your birth date is between March 21st and April 19th, that's the sign of Aries. The Sun and Jupiter's clash delivers an ego boost. Do not let success go to your head. For Taurus, birthdays from April 20th to May 20th, are you tempted to turn down solid advice because you believe that you know it all? For Geminis, birthdays from May 21st to June 21st, are you spending liberally? You are treating your friends to good things. For Cancer, birthdays from June 22nd through July 22nd, are you basking in your success? It's your lucky day, but avoid resting on your laurels. For Leos, birthdays from July 23rd through August 22nd, are you feeling untouchable? You are cosmically protected, but arrogant behavior will not get a pass. For you fellow Virgos out there with birthdates from August 23rd through September 22nd, you flaunt your influence. The subtler move is the smarter one. For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birthdates, are you showered with support? Well, lean on your relationships for some extra luck. For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birthdates. Oh, are you volunteering for more? You are game to take on extra task. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birthdates. Are you tempted to overdo it? Please know your limits to stay out of trouble or debt. For Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th birthdates, you are basking in the glow of a loved one's affection. What could go wrong? Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birthdates, are you hyping up your skills? Well, take point on an assignment, but be aware of your bandwidth. And finally, Pisces, birthdates from February 19th to March 20th. You want more. However, gains are only gratifying if you can keep them. And that was today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. The first letter goes like this. Dear Abby, my husband is very temperamental. When something goes wrong with his meal or service at a restaurant, or when he's driving and gets upset with another driver, he angrily vents to me nonstop, repeating the same things over and over. This happens only when we are alone, not when friends or family members are present. When I ask him to please stop because it's upsetting or stressful or giving me indigestion if we're having a meal, he blames me and says I have to let him vent and say nothing, not even ask him to please stop so I can enjoy my food. We argue often about this. I've tried talking to him about it when he isn't upset. His response is always the same. I need to deal with it. If I try to reason with him, he justifies and excuses his behavior and puts the blame back on me. I want to run away from this marriage because of it. By the way, he's almost 70 years old, and he's been doing this his entire life. Signed, Ready to Flee in Tennessee. And Abby responds, Dear Ready, how many decades have the two of you been married? If it's less than one, Rather than tolerate more of your husband's verbal abuse, consult a lawyer. If, however, this has been happening for the entire duration of your marriage, I can't help but wonder why it has taken you so long to write. Your husband obviously can control his behavior if he wishes. If there is a financial reason for remaining married, you didn't once mention in your letter that you love this bully. This is the price that you are paying for years of security. You do not have to tolerate being berated. Because you are nearing the end of your rope, offer him a choice. Therapy for his verbal aggression or separation so you no longer have to bear the brunt of it. Our next letter goes, Dear Abby, I was recently at our local recreation center working out. At one point, I was stretching my back and a friend, Seth, happened upon me from a distance. He thought I looked funny in my pose and took a few pics of me to share with other friends. Now, I don't have an issue with that. The issue is a teenager and his father, with whom I'm acquainted, were nearby in the line of sight of Seth's photos. The father, whom Seth does not know, accused him of taking pics of his teenager. Seth was offended and angry and denied it, but he didn't feel he could show the pics of me to the father. And now Seth is being accused of something he didn't do. Should I step in and resolve the issue and tell the father what actually happened? Signed, In the Middle in Texas. And Abby responds, Dear In the Middle, you certainly should. If you don't, Seth could find himself in serious trouble. And the note goes to my readers, for those who celebrate Easter, I wish you all a meaningful and memorable day. Happy Easter, everyone. Don't forget that Dear Abby is written by Abigail Van Buren, also known as Jean Phillips. The column was founded by her mother, Pauline Phillips. You can contact Abigail in two ways. One way is to go to her website, www.dearabby.com, or you can write her a letter and mail it to P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, zip code 90069. And those were the letters of advice. In the comic strip, Zitz, drawn by Jerry Scott and Jim Borgman, Jeremy and his friend Hector are having, looks like sandwiches at lunchtime at the kitchen table. Dad comes in with his coffee cup and he says, Well, how has your car been working lately, Jeremy? And Jeremy says, Well, it always starts. Doesn't have any weird noises or smells. You know, random pieces don't fall off. And it hasn't given me an excuse for being late for school even once. And so as he takes his sandwich and he and Hector start to walk away from Dad, Jeremy says, So, not great. And Hector goes, You know, I miss the van, too. And that was Zitz. And then, in the comic strip Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker, the first frame has Beetle saying, I can nap in a bed. And there's picture of him taking a nap. Then he says, I can nap in a chair. And there he is, napping in a chair. I can nap in a tent. We see his feet sticking out of the tent as he snores. Or I can nap next to a bear. And he's taking a snooze next to a bear. I can nap in a tree or in the air. I can nap most anywhere. When he says that, there's a picture of an explosion going off and he's in a foxhole. And then he says, I can nap all day. And then in the last frame, oh, there's Sergeant Snorkel, and he yells, Beetle! And Beetle thinks, as long as Sarge isn't there, I can nap in a bed. I can nap in a chair. I can nap in a tent or next to a bear. I can nap in a tree or in the air. I can nap most anywhere. I can nap all day. As long as Sarge isn't there, as Sarge yells, Beetle! And that was Beetle Bailey. Then we've got Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall. And it looks like their son Alexander says, What's Dad doing outside so early? And Blondie says, well, he's getting everything ready for the Easter egg hunt. And the next frame, there's Dagwood, and he's hiding Easter eggs. And the kids are looking out the window with Blondie, and his daughter says, don't you think we're a little old to be hunting for Easter eggs? And Blondie says, oh, they're not for you. In the last frame, they watch as Dagwood yells, go get 'em, girl. And the dog Daisy starts running after all the eggs. And that was Blondie. And in the comic strip, Baby Blues, drawn by Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott. In the first frame, Wanda, the mom, is sitting on the floor in the living room. And she's got a laundry basket, and she's folding clothes as she sits on the floor, and she's folding clothes on the sofa table. And in comes Wren, crawling on the floor towards Mom. And the next frame, Wren bonks her head on the coffee table and then sits up and looks at Mom. And Mom looks back at Wren. Nothing's happening. Next frame, Mom's still looking at Wren. Wren's still looking at Mom. Nothing's happening. And the last frame, Mom says, owie? And Wren immediately starts crying. Wah! And that was Baby Blues. Well, before we go, we ought to wish happy birthday to some celebrities. Who's celebrating today? The singer from the group ABBA, her name is Agnethy Fältskog. She turns 76 today, and actress Krista Allen turns 55, and rapper Pharrell Williams turns 53, and actor Sterling K. Brown turns 50 today. Congratulations and happy birthday. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you have been listening to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, April 5th, 2026. Happy Easter, everyone. Bye-bye.